This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African-American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, activists plan to counter President Trump's threatened crackdown on so-called sanctuary cities by expanding the movement to resist unjust laws and government repression. And prison abolitionists say the U.S. system of mass incarceration is a continuation of old-time slavery. They plan a millions march for prisoners' human rights in Washington this summer.
But first, Donald Trump's ban on refugees and visitors from seven mostly Muslim countries is a reflection of the new president's larger vision of who should be an American, according to author and activist Arun Kunani. Kunani recently wrote an article titled "Recharging the Batteries of Whiteness, Trump's New Racial Identity Politics." But Trump's anti-Muslim policies are nothing new. Kunani says the seven targeted countries had already been singled out for special treatment under the Obama administration.
The text did not actually name the seven countries. It didn't need to, because it referenced the previous executive order that the Obama administration had made, in which those seven countries were already named. And so, you know, to some extent, the Trump administration people are correct when they say that what they are doing is actually building on something that was already in place under Obama. The kind of fascism that Trump is developing is not starting from scratch. It builds on a longer history that is not exclusively a Republican Party history. And that's one of the striking things about the executive order that was introduced. The other thing I would say is the history in the United States of immigration policy is a history of attempts to use immigration policy to regulate the ethnic composition of the United States. And so in a society that has a history of white supremacy, immigration law becomes a way of trying to preserve the whiteness of the United States. And I think this immigration ban from these seven Muslim-majority countries needs to be seen in that context. Right now, the focus is on particular nationals of those seven countries who are Muslim. The non-Muslim minorities in those countries are not being treated the same way. But the logic of this is much broader, and it is about a program of ethnic regulation of the population of the United States.
Yes, the United States describes itself as having been shaped by immigration, but one could also describe it as having been shaped by selective immigration policies that excluded whole regions of the world. For example, Africans were not a part of any quota for entrance into the United States, even though at the time of the U.S.'s founding, one out of five of the folks who lived in those colonies were Africans.
Right. And when people say America is a nation of immigrants, I feel the need to correct that and say, no, historically, America is a nation of natives, of slaves, and of settler colonials. The word immigrant kind of conceals a history that is really a history of settler colonialism, which means people coming from Europe, colonizing someone else's land, and then importing slaves to work on that land. Now, what happens more recently, from 1965 onwards, is that the immigration policy has changed so that it's no longer a white-focused policy. And that's a result of the Black freedom struggle, the rights movement, which has a knock-on effect in immigration policy that people often forget about. So that post-1965, we start to talk about this idea of a kind of multicultural America with immigration from across the whole world that's meant to be a balance of the different parts of the world. And I think Trump's agenda is really about rolling back the idea of that. It was never completely practiced, but at least rolling back the idea of that so that we move to an idea again of a white supremacist America, both in terms of domestic institutional racism and also in terms of immigration policy and foreign policy. And if you look at the kinds of ideology coming from people like Stephen Bannon, people like Stephen Miller, Jeff Sessions, all the people that Trump has placed around him, that is clearly their vision.
So this multi-ethnic vision of America is only about two generations old, and clearly there is not a consensus about that, as evidenced by Donald Trump's actions, and he is the president.
Absolutely, and that idea of multicultural, multi-ethnic America that came out of the 1960s was always somewhat ambiguous anyway. The people who benefited from it were people who were immigrating from Asia, from Africa, who tended to be the people that the US system thought that they wanted, while a whole load of others would be excluded. So, you know, the PhD students that would then follow through into working for the US government, US corporations in very specialized technical roles, people like Barack Obama's father, for example. It was those kinds of people that were being invited to be a part of American society. Working class people of color were not invited. And what's more, those people that were being invited from around the world to be the technicians of American society, you know, think of all those Silicon Valley Indians who are working there on H-1B visas, and some of which have become citizens of the United States. But not only are they being invited into these technical roles within the U.S. economy while others are being excluded, but they're also being invited into a kind of American history of whiteness as well. So they're being invited to think of themselves as better than African-Americans, for example, so that they can kind of be accepted in these kind of ambiguous terms where they're kind of almost white. And, you know, I think one of the things that politically we're going to have to see now is whether all those communities of people who have felt like maybe they can find a place in suburban America because they're not, maybe not white, but almost white, you know, people who are Arab, people who are South Asian, East Asian, where do those people now stand? Are they going to stand on the side of a kind of anti-racist freedom struggle that wants to take on white supremacy in all its forms? Or are they going to try to integrate themselves into this new racial project that we've seen come from Trump? And to the extent that I've seen numbers that say something like 20% of South Asians in the United States voted for Trump, you can see that there is a constituency there of people who think that there's something for them there, and that they're deluded, but that's there. And so this is something that I think we need to confront. And sometimes when we talk about the rights of immigrants and when we talk about people of color, these words conceal some of these ambiguities.
Yes, some folks make a big deal out of projections that the United States will no longer have a white Anglo majority by about 2042 or 2043. But actually, it's much more complex than that, in that some groups may be, well, to use the word that black folks used to deploy, some folks may be passing effectively by then.
Yeah, and I think that's the appropriate term. And this is going to be one of the key issues now. You know, a non-white majority is not the same thing as the end of white supremacy. You only need to know a little about the history of South Africa or the history of other colonized countries to understand that. So the challenge is going to be whether the different communities, whether it's Latino communities or Asian communities, or even for African immigrant communities, where it's going to be possible to politicize them in a way that enables them to understand the history here, to understand the deal that is being offered to them might sound nice. It might sound like something where they can have some security and some future in the United States. But what the Trump administration demonstrates, I think, is how precarious that is. Many Muslims in the United States, before 9/11, they thought that they were part of the American dream. They would be living reasonably comfortable lives, many of them in the suburbs of U.S. cities. And then 9/11 happens, and suddenly they're the enemy. And I think it's taken many of those, particularly in more kind of well-off sections of that community, it's taken them a very long time to understand that is not going to go away without some kind of political struggle. I think they assumed that you could just wait around and the magic of the American system would correct itself automatically, but it does not. And certainly black Muslims have tried their best to explain to other Muslims that the history here would indicate something different than the idea of auto-correcting. So even now, you know, many Muslims are still in this mindset where they say, I'm just going to wave the American flag and keep my head down and wait for this to go away. And the reality is that we need communities that are strong and confident and that unite around a shared politics of opposing white supremacy, both in the current form that we have from Trump, but also in the kind of longer, more deeply rooted form that reach beyond that.
Yes, I can remember when Lebanese, especially Christian Lebanese, were treated as if they were white and felt themselves to be so. But that was before vicious anti-Arab sentiments became so strong.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And you know, you can trace the history of this in Supreme Court decisions, right? I mean, many different immigrant communities at different times in the 20th century petitioned the Supreme Court to be recognized as white. There is a whole legal history here of Indians, of people from the Middle East, going to the Supreme Court and saying, please recognize us as white. Even today, the official administrative department that handles the census defines people from the Middle East as white, because that was the Supreme Court ruling that came from the middle of the 20th century. And obviously, back in the 1930s or so, when these cases were taking place, being recognized as white was about wanting to secure your civil rights in the United States, because those were rooted in being white. Well, unfortunately, that history has enabled people to think that whiteness is some kind of inherent quality in their very nature, whereas, as we know, race is socially and historically constructed. And so your whiteness is always precarious if you come from the Middle East or if you're Asian. And clinging to it is not a very smart strategy, actually, for securing your rights, because what the war on terror has demonstrated is that whiteness can be taken away from groups as much as it can be something that is won by groups.
Yes, the perverse nature of the immigration policy of the United States is highlighted by the fact that these seven countries that were selected by President Obama and now selected again by Donald Trump for this special treatment are all countries that the United States has been engaged in military or economic warfare with.
Absolutely. And I think five of those countries, Somalia, Libya, Yemen, Syria, and Iraq, are countries that right now the United States is involved in military actions and essentially is at war with the people of those countries. So there is something very odd here. I mean, if you look at, take the example of Iraq, for example, in the 1960s, the U.S. government engineered a coup in Iraq and overthrew the popular government, leading to thousands of people killed. In the 1970s, U.S. interventions led to thousands of deaths. In the 1980s, the U.S. government supported both sides in the Iran-Iraq war, in which hundreds of thousands of people died. In the 1990s, we went to war in Iraq. Then we introduced a sanctions regime that led to hundreds of thousands of dying. We had the war of aggression against Iraq in 2003 that led to hundreds of thousands of people dying. Last year, we dropped something like 12,000 bombs in Iraq. And this year we're saying that we don't want to let Iraqis into the United States because they might be violent. Well, I think the irony there is obvious, but we tend to lose sight of that history when we debate the immigration ban as if somehow it is based on some kind of genuine concern about national security. It's not really anything to do with national security. It's to do with an attempt to define who is American and who is not, who is an enemy and who is not. And it's an attempt to actually shut down the possibility that people from these backgrounds can actually speak to us about that history. You know, one of the consequences of this ban is that it's going to be much harder, for example, for people from Yemen or people from Somalia to come to the United States and say, this is what it means to be on the receiving end of drone strikes. This is what it means to be on the receiving end of the various kinds of violence that the U.S. government has perpetrated, right? So it becomes a kind of censorship as well as a way of separating and preventing people from being able to be with their families or participate in American society. Right now, there are something like 5,000 academics who have signed a boycott where they're saying that they will boycott the United States and not come to international academic conferences that are held within the United States in solidarity with people who are unable to travel to the United States because of the new executive order, right? So what's happening is that people are understanding that the conversations, the intellectual debate is not going to be possible in the United States in the same way anymore, because a whole section of humanity is being shut out from those debates. And so those debates will have to take place outside the United States now.
So U.S. policy has sparked a kind of BDS campaign, or the beginnings of one, against the U.S., as has been the case with Israel.
It's not exactly the same as BDS because the focus is very narrow. It's not on all kinds of cultural activity. It's on a very specific thing, which is the big international academic conferences where you would have 3,000 or 4,000 people come from around the world. And these conferences are self-styled international conferences. The idea is that all the scholars in a particular field get together and share their research and debate. Now, given the ban, it is ridiculous to say that these conferences can take place in the United States and still claim the mantle of being international when, you know, millions of people are being told that they're no longer able to come to the United States, even to visit, to participate in a conference. And so I think it's things like that where the focus will be. Big questions around sporting events now. In Britain, the most well-known current athlete is a guy called Mo Farah, who is born in Somalia. Huge star, no longer able to travel to the United States, right? Strong arguments are saying international sporting events should not take place in the United States, but should take place outside. We know about filmmakers who won't be able to go to the Oscars because they're Iranian. So across all kinds of different spheres, I think we're going to be seeing resistance that it takes the form of a boycott or at least pressure to relocate international events outside the United States.
So these policies are resulting in lines being drawn around the United States.
Absolutely. I mean, there's no doubt that not only amongst the Middle East and Muslim majority countries, but in Europe, in Asia and Africa, that, you know, these kinds of measures simply diminish the reputation, whatever remains of the reputation of the United States. And so the effect is actually to marginalize the United States. And so if there is anyone who believes that these measures are somehow designed to protect the United States and defend its position in the world, in fact, the practical outcomes will be counterproductive because more and more of the kind of interaction between nations and between peoples will no longer be centered on the United States. And, you know, we're already seeing that, for example, I mean, one of the most striking things over the last few weeks is which country in the world is now most enthusiastic in its public rhetoric from government leaders about the process of globalization. It's China, right? So China, the country that for years was saw globalization as a threat, feared economic integration into the global capitalist economy, now it's the biggest cheerleader for that process. And the United States has become the country that fears integration with the rest of the world. And so it's a kind of incredible reversal from the position in the 1990s, where it would have been the opposite. And I think we'll see more and more of that, where other parts of the world are starting to develop a growing kind of global integration and partnerships across the world, regional alliances and agreements, whether that's within East Asia or whether that's within Africa, all of which will increasingly bypass the United States. And the United States will be left isolated and alone with perhaps one remaining friend in the world, which is Israel.
The Trump administration called the seven countries that were targeted terrorism prone, but two of them, specifically Libya and Syria, are countries that the United States has been exporting terrorism to.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, Libya is a country that just in the last few years has been on the receiving end of a completely misguided military action from the United States and France and Britain. I mean, I think very few people now disagree with the obvious conclusion that this military action in 2011 that overthrew Gaddafi, that it was misguided and has left the country much worse off in terms of violence and conflict and instability. And the assumption behind this, the Trump team would like us to take and absorb, is that somehow there is something inherent to Islam that turns people into terrorists, hence the Muslim ban. The reality is that when you look at actual histories of when does political violence take place, and if we want to use the word terrorism, what are the circumstances in which terrorism becomes more likely? Well, the answer is not that it becomes more likely the more that people believe in Islam. The answer is that it becomes more likely when you put people in situations where the state, whether it's the United States government or its allies or other countries, where governments use mass violence against people's efforts to try and achieve freedom for themselves, when people feel oppressed, when they feel that there's no prospects of their achieving their political goals through non-violent processes, that's when people turn to violence. And you see that history time and time again, whether you're Muslim or not, the same thing applies. And so I think if we want to understand why does ISIS exist, why does Al-Qaeda exist, why does Hamas exist, the answer is the same. It's that these are the products of political history, not religious history.
That was author and activist Arun Kunani.
President Trump has long threatened to crack down on so-called sanctuary cities that refuse to collaborate in the mass deportation of undocumented immigrants. However, rather than go on the defensive, activists are vowing to broaden the sanctuary movement beyond immigration issues. According to Sue Udry, executive director of the Bill of Rights Defense Committee, the movement will be expanded to include resistance to other forms of state repression.
Exactly. And then also to expand on the idea of what it means to be a sanctuary city. So historically, it's been creating cities where people who are here without documentation, immigrants who come to the country without documentation, where they can feel safe and able to live and try to be good members of our society. The birth of the sanctuary city movement came out of refugees coming from Central America, fleeing wars in Central America, but proxy U.S. wars in Central America. But it's been expanded recently to just talk about how city police, city or state or county police, are going to not necessarily be the agents of immigration and custom enforcement, right? What the federal government wants is for local police to really act as their agents and inform on undocumented immigrants within their city's borders and to otherwise aid and abet ICE. And so a lot of cities can actually look at that as an unfunded mandate, right? It's not the job of local police to enforce federal law. It's the job of local police to enforce local laws and to work with the community. So that's where we are now with sanctuary cities. But we want to expand on the ideas and say, you know what, local police should also not be helping the federal government to enforce Trump's idea of a Muslim registry or Trump's idea of putting surveillance on every single mosque in the country or Trump's idea that dissent is un-American and that local people should not be organizing to counter any Trump initiatives. So what we're asking people to do, local activists to do, is to get their local police to not cooperate with the FBI, with the FBI's Joint Terrorism Task Force, and to not enforce these initiatives coming down from Trump that we find so offensive.
And of course, the FBI's spying on Muslims did not begin with Trump. For example, even the New York City Police Department was illegally spying out of state on Muslims in neighboring New Jersey. So this has been something that was pervasive before Trump.
Yeah, I'll confess that we're just kind of, it is true, it's been happening. It happened during the Obama administration, the Bush administration, the Clinton administration. You know, it's been going on for 100 years that the FBI has been using its authorities to both crush dissent and to infiltrate and spy on immigrants that they don't like. So it's not new with Trump, but I think with the Trump presidency, you know, this is work that we've been doing since 1960, Glenn, but with Trump as president, people can more clearly see the harm that it's doing. You know, when Obama was doing it, people gave him a pass because he's such a nice guy. But with Trump, it's so very clear how dangerous this is and also the really evil intent behind it. It's so clear when it's Trump doing it, whereas you can't see that so much when other presidents were doing it.
So Donald Trump has put a very ugly face on an already existing practice, which creates opportunities for those of us who've been opposed to those practices all along.
Exactly. But we do need to be clear that when it's coming from this current administration, it is actually exponentially worse, I think, than under any other administration. I think we do need to be clear about that, but this sort of thing has been going on, but it's a whole different level now that we're looking at.
What do you mean a whole different level?
Well, I think that what Obama and Bush tried to do, and I think they perhaps sincerely tried to do this, they did not have open contempt and hatred and fear of basically of Muslim people, right, or of Islam. I think that their policies were very Islamophobic, but it wasn't their intent. It's like, I think they didn't do it with animus, whereas Trump clearly, and so many of his top aides, clearly have animus towards Muslims, and they really want to, beyond the policies they're imposing, they really want to make people fear and hate Muslims, which I don't think was the intent behind Bush and Obama's practices. So then with that, Trump will be ratcheting up these programs. And I think it's truly frightening, and I think we need to fight back.
And how are you going about organizing this kind of defense at the local level?
So it's really important that people understand that they do have the power in their cities and counties and even states to really push back on the Trump agenda. And I think that's really exciting, is that a lot of people have been feeling kind of at a loss, because if you look at Congress, there's not a whole lot that we can do there. I think we still need to fight at that level, but it's a little bit easy to become despairing when you look nationally. But if you look locally, there really is a lot that we can do, and that's where people can hook in. And we are working together with a bunch of groups, including Council on American and Islamic Relations, the Asian Americans Advancing Justice, Chicago Youth Project, Hands Up United, Live Free, Black Movement Law Project, the PICO National Network, and a bunch of other groups. And we've launched a campaign called Stop Trump Intel Pro, which is a play on, if folks I know that listen to Black Agenda Report know about COINTELPRO. So we're calling it Trump Intel Pro. And we've launched a website that gives people tools to work in their local communities to confront the Trump agenda as far as cooperating with the FBI. So people can just go visit the website at TrumpIntelPro.com.
Well, what about the larger precedent of encouraging local jurisdictions not to cooperate or collaborate with the Justice Department? There's this long, long history among traditional Black civil rights organizations for relying on federal intervention against racist practices by state and county and local jurisdictions. This kind of turns that logic on its head.
Yeah, I know that a lot of civil rights groups are extremely concerned that we're just not going to be able to count on the Justice Department to play the role that it did play, particularly under the Obama administration. And so people really need to take it in their own hands. And it is worrisome, Glenn, because in cities that maybe voted for Trump, it's going to be very hard for people to hold their local police accountable. But you've got city police in Chicago, in Cleveland, in New York, who some of them are operating under consent decrees or were about to sign consent decrees with the Department of Justice. And these are cities that did not support Donald Trump. And so these are cities where the mayor and where activists should be able to, politically, there's an opening there for them to install really strong guidelines on their local police and use this opportunity of, you know, we've got to fight Trump and we're going to fight it here in our city. Our mayor says that he or she is against Trump and all of his racist, Islamophobic, anti-immigrant policies. Don't just give us speeches. Don't just give us resolutions that say we're a warm and welcoming city and we love everybody. Impose strong guidelines on our police to ensure that our police are not using excessive militarization, they're not racial profiling, or using other discriminatory forms of profiling. This is the time where there needs to be some leadership coming from these cities, from these progressive liberal cities. They need to show leadership and they need to slam shut the door against Trump's policies and against cooperating with the federal government on so many levels.
And what's the next event or series of events in your timeline?
Well, what we're going to be doing is hosting some conference calls and possibly webinars, but I think conference calls are easy for those of us who are less tech savvy. We'll be hosting a series of conference calls, and we'll announce that on our website. We don't have everything all set, but if people visit TrumpIntelco.com, you can see resources to help you get started, and then also just check out our website at the Bill of Rights Defense Committee, which is BORDC.org, and sign up for our newsletter and alerts, and we'll invite you to a series of conference calls that will address all these different issues so that people can really figure out how to organize locally. I know there's people and I know there's energy, and people are a little bit flailing around now looking for what to do in something that's not just symbolic, and I think this is it.
And in fact, you have had some encouraging developments from, of all people, the cops themselves.
Yeah, it's amazing, Glenn. So this campaign really got started a few years ago in San Francisco, where local activists worked very hard to get the San Francisco police to promise to obey their own guidelines, the city of San Francisco and state of California rules regarding particularly racial profiling. They had to follow their own rules instead of the FBI's rules when they were doing work with the FBI's Joint Terrorism Task Force. So activists were able to get San Francisco police to agree to that. But then on Wednesday night, of all things, the police themselves said that they were going to pull out of their agreement with the FBI's Joint Terrorism Task Force, and they were no longer going to even work with the Joint Terrorism Task Force there. So amazing news out of San Francisco, and we need to get that to happen in cities around the country, just to give notice to the FBI that no more can they count on local police to be their foot soldier in imposing these racist, Islamophobic, anti-immigrant policies.
So you think the San Francisco police might turn out to be a model?
Yes. So as San Francisco goes, so shall go the whole country, we hope.
That was Sue Oudry of the Bill of Rights Defense Committee speaking from Washington.
Anti-mass incarceration activists from across the country will converge on Washington, D.C. on August 19th for a Millions for Prisoners Human Rights March. Black Agenda Radio producer Kyle Frazier spoke with one of the organizers, Brother D, of the Incarcerated Workers Organizing Committee, and Jailhouse Lawyers Speak. Brother D prefers not to give his full name to avoid retribution by the authorities. He explained what the march in August is all about.
Well, the Millions for Prisoners Human Rights March is a march or a demonstration, as most of us back here in prison like to call it, a demonstration on the powers that be that are located in Washington, D.C., which is why we call it a march on Washington, because Washington is the symbolic power center of this country. It is a collective or coalition of groups, people, organizations, and prisoners coming together to demand the abolishment of legalized slavery in this country that is perpetuated in the 13th Amendment to the United States Constitution. Of course, we feel that the 13th Amendment of the United States Constitution is the trigger to a lot of other issues that we have in our communities, particularly in the new African communities around in this country, all the way down to the school pipeline, all the way to in the prisons themselves, where they actually have virtual slave labor taking place. So that is what the Millions for Prisoners Human Rights goals and objectives are, to get there in Washington, to bring mass attention, to ask for a congressional hearing to address the 13th Amendment, to look at it, to investigate it, to come to a conclusion that it is a human rights violation under international law and that it must be changed. And from there, we hope to be able to ask for a constitutional convention to take place to where this amendment that allows legalized slavery in prisons and juvenile facilities and a host of other places, slavery to take place. And I think next you asked me about the EWOC. What is EWOC's position into this right here? We are, at the end of the day, our main focus has always been, since the September 9th prison strike, is to bring attention to the 13th Amendment, or to be more specific, to bring attention to the slave labor that's taking place inside the prisons. One of the best ways that we figured as prisoners to address the slave labor that is taking place inside the prisons is to unionize. And we feel through unionization, it gives us, through unionizing, it gives us the option to play, to move collectively, to have outside resources. This is definitely welcome, and again, giving us those outside resources to connect us in areas we was not connected to areas previously, to ensure that the connection with other EY members that's in prison throughout the country, to ensure that we all have that that sync and that harmony going on, you know. So at the end of the day, we feel like by unionizing in prison, and as a union with EY, we feel that we definitely can control some action on the ground as it relates to abolishing legalized slavery in this country.
In your view, where is the 13th Amendment and its exception clause with regard to the public conversation currently, and how significant is that exception clause with respect to this issue of prisoners' human rights and prison slavery?
I think for prisoners, for years, we've been complaining. One of the earliest complaints, you can go all the way back to some of the earliest complaints out towards California, San Quentin, all the way up to the most known massacre that took place in Attica Prison in New York, all the way up to the September 9th strike, recently just took place. You would know each one of them have had some notice of prison slave labor taking place. You know, some notice of we want to be done with this. This is what's going on in these prisons. They are enslaving us. You know, they are have us in some of the most inhumane conditions. You know, and so that way, instead of spending money, meaning paying people their fair wages, improving living conditions, they have maximized profits through dehumanizing us and having forcing us to live in inhumane conditions. So it is definitely high on the priority list of prisoners. I think within the last 3 to 4 years, it has definitely heightened more and heightened all the way up to, once again, to the September 9th strike. And also, we got to look at Sister Abel. She did her film, The 13th, which put a lot of attention on the 13th Amendment of the United States Constitution. And I think it would have really have reinvigorated the new abolitionist movement, you know, which is what a lot of us is calling this right now, you know, that the new abolitionist movement. And our focus on it is like, I mean, I'm going to tell you, I don't think I have seen this type of focus on the 13th Amendment years previously to the last 2 or 3 years. You know, this is like the climax of it here, you know. So, I mean, we are definitely, I see it building, and I see it becoming a atomic bomb. And it's just waiting to explode. It's ticking. And I'm hoping that some changes definitely take place, because I don't think that prisoners themselves are going to be staying in line too much more longer under these type of conditions that are, once again, that are completely influenced and perpetuated by the 13th Amendment of the United States Constitution.
So there are some who say, well, perhaps this is what the text of the 13th Amendment states, but that doesn't mean that it's actually being acted upon. You know, that doesn't mean that they're actually enslaving people in the United States, you know, in the present day. What do you say to those people? And what is the importance of referring to what's happening in the prisons in the United States as slavery?
I think one of the things we have to recognize, when Frederick Douglass was on the scene, and, you know, his main, when he heard the Emancipation Proclamation was passed, he went to Washington, D.C. to actually condemn it as a trick, as duping the people, as it was going to take another face upon the nation. It was going to be much, much worse than what it was then. And I reference Frederick Douglass because I'm a New African freedom fighter. So as a New African freedom fighter, I recognize that when Africans was brought to the shore, they was brought here in chains. They was brought here under the lash, okay? And I know for over 400 plus years, they fought. They fought as abolitionists to change their conditions to rid themselves of slavery. So when you had the Civil War, and I hate to have to get into this little moment like this, but it has to be explained. When you had the Civil War that took place, there was a compromise that was made against the South and the North. And this compromise was that slavery would allow to be continued just under different pretexts, just under different conditions. Instead of it being privately owned now, it would be government and state owned, you know. So prisoners themselves became commodities. And when I look at the New African community, and I got to reflect back to them specifically, I see that they had began to automatically arrest them for a lot of bogus charges in order to get them back in prison, to get them into things that were known as sharecropping, to get them on the convict lease. They caught them on things they called the pig laws, you know. And this at that time, was continuing a process. So slavery had never ended. It just had met. It was just a compromise took place. I don't take the Constitution for saying anything other than what it says. The Constitution itself in this country defines this as slavery. It doesn't define it as anything else. It is an exception clause, and it is slavery. So for the ones that, you know, like, that kind of downplays it, I think a lot of the reason why some of these individuals downplay it, don't want to recognize it for what it is, because they don't want to look at the negative impact of capitalism inside this country. They don't want to look at the fact that slavery was a continuous institution, that the chain never broke, that Abraham Lincoln did not free anybody. Instead, he just changed the game up on it. So, you know, I don't get it when people read the Constitution and they say, this is not what it is. No, it's not taking place. You know, I don't get it.
To take it back to the demonstration that's coming up in August, how are you and the Twin Cities IWOC preparing and organizing toward this demonstration? And what are some of the other organizations involved in that effort?
Right now, just speaking from a prisoner's perspective, we have a number of different organizations on the ground. Jailhouse lawyers speak with the actual prison organization that actually calls the demonstration to take place, which I'm also a part of that as well. We have Amendment 13, which is a group out of California, which is also a prisoner-dominated group. We have Free Alabama Movement. They've joined the call. We have Free Ohio Movement. They've joined the call. We have George Jackson University, which is another predominant prison group. They've joined the call. We have a number of other different prison groups. We even have a number of prisoners inside that are part of street organizations that have also taken up the cause. And this is just within the prison context. Now, outside of prison, we have the Jericho Movement joined the call. We have Black Lives Matter Charleston that has joined the call. We have... The list goes on, and I would suggest that anyone that wants to see the list, we have over 50 to 60 different organizations at this particular time that have joined the call. I would suggest you go to imweubuntu.com, and it's a solidarity list up, and it will list every single organization that I've named and plus the other 40 to 50 that are listed as showing that they've actually joined this call to help us network to make this demonstration on Washington and other areas throughout the country, because we plan on having satellite demonstrations taking place in other areas throughout the country to the actual reality and to impact this country in a way that they haven't seen it, that they haven't been impacted before.
For those individuals and groups who are not yet involved in the planning efforts of this March for Prisoners' Human Rights, how could they get involved in this? What are some of the suggested actions for people not yet in that process?
Well, it's a number of different actions we ask people to take individually. People can go to, once again, imweubuntu.com. It's a distribution list. It's a distribution page on that webpage where you can get flyers, you can download flyers, you can pass out these flyers, you can send these flyers to your friends, your organizations that you see that are not already listed. Call them, contact them, encourage them to get involved. We need everybody's voice. This is purely a grassroots initiative. We're also requesting that people take the initiative to organize themselves. Once again, if you can't make it to Washington, D.C., we're asking you to organize your city for a demonstration. We're asking you to contact your local affiliates and asking them, can they get involved? Will they come out? Will they support you in your local city? You may also contact the organizers of this particular demonstration. You can definitely contact them by sending an email to meetingsforprisonersmarch@gmail.com. Or you can also contact us through EWOC. All of us is working together. This is one big family here, and we're trying to make this happen. We plan on impacting this system, and from my perspective, tear this capitalistic beat down, you know?
Definitely. Now, this march is slated for right in the middle of Black August. Was that an intentional choice?
The reason Black August was selected, very similar to the way September 9th was selected to make sure that people understand these are historical moments for prisoners, or historical commemoration times for prisoners. So Black August is also another time when prisoners are recognizing the struggle through what we call a prison resistance movement, recognizing what we're going through, recognizing what we have to face and what we need to change. And we're hoping that by selecting Black artists, it forces people to take a look into the prison resistance movement to get a better understanding of what is the nature of prisons in this country. And not only what is the nature of the prisons in this country, but to look at some of the solutions that people have come up with to dismantle this prison industrial enslavement complex. So this is why we selected Black August, because there was no other month that could be chosen. I think that Black August definitely highlights some of the changes that need to be made. It highlights some of the sacrifices that have actually been made. And not only that, but it is a month that nationally that prisoners definitely understand that this is a month that we consider ours. So we wanted the public, this is society, to take part in this month of Black August with us. So this is why Black August was actually selected. And last but not least, if I didn't say it, because it is a month of resistance. And August the 19th, we wanted to be known as a month of resistance.
No doubt. Now, in 2015, we saw the uprising in MTC out in Texas. As you mentioned, September 9th of last year marked the beginning of the nationwide prison strike. And most recently, we had the uprising that occurred in Delaware out at Vaughn Correctional Center. So what do these uprisings say to you about the state of resistance against prison slavery? And do you have any comments or information that you would like to bring out specifically toward the recent developments in Delaware?
Well, I think that what we're actually seeing is, first of all, let me say that what we're seeing is a gigantic influx of activity around the nation. I don't think, I've heard some say it hasn't been seen since the early 60s and 70s, you know, the activities that's actually taking place in the prisons now amongst the prisoners nationally. And also the connections that prisoners have found around the United States with each other, the way we've been able to communicate, the way we've been able to plan and strategize together. I think that is unseen and unheard of. And for us as prisoners to do it, we actually feel we need to do so. We are in a desperate position at this particular moment for changes. I think in Delaware, what we recently saw in Delaware was another example of desperation. You saw rebellion take place. And how you know this was a rebellion, and in my eyes, it was a legitimate rebellion, because they said, we want to be heard. When you have people go through extreme measures, extreme action, just to be heard, it is that bad. A lot of prisoners are fearful to act in that particular with that particular energy that they acted. But it does not mean that a lot of prisoners are not feeling the same energy, the same want, the same desire. And actually, everything they said is everything we've been talking about nationally. I don't care if it's in California, if it's in Texas, if it's in Delaware, if it's in New York, if it's in Ohio. We are all as prisoners faced with the same situation. And sometimes what people don't realize is that a lot of these prisoners, they are tired of being warehoused. And it is a warehouse system. We know prisoners themselves are the commodity. We cannot get around that. We are the profit for some corporation or for some company out there, you know, which is why the slave catchers capture us, whether dead or alive out there, and get us up in here, which is why laws is made to ensure that we serve maximum amount of time and a lot of times disproportionately for certain offenses that occur. I think that Delaware is a prime example of actually what prisoners are actually feeling in this country. And if you pay attention to what Delaware said, education, rehabilitation, you know, these are things that you would think America would be doing anyway. These are things you would think these penal institutions are set up for to do. But what people are starting to learn is that the Constitution, which allows them to capture us, bother us, and sell us to the highest bidder, the bidder has the constitutional right to make a profit off of us. But yet, the prisoners themselves do not have the constitutional right to rehabilitation, habilitation, treatment, a reentry program. And so when you have that going on and not being heard, no one seems to be paying attention those type of rebellions will continue to take place. You know, they will continue to take place, and I expect to see many more. We had a conference call probably 3 nights ago, and some of the prisoners that we were having the conference call with was expressing their frustration, and was expressing the frustration not only with the way the prisons are going, but the language that Trump is actually talking. They don't see Trump as actually being a benefit to what's going on. Of course, many of us, we see the system as one and the same. It doesn't matter who you have in there. But particularly Trump, due to the way he's talking, prisoners are definitely seeing no change. They are seeing, as a matter of fact, they fear that there's going to be an increase in the prison slave population. So with all that we just said, the guys that was already hanging on by a thread, hoping for some change so that they can be better men and better women, are now being told nothing is going to change. It's only going to get worse. So it makes them more desperate, you know. And so I fully do expect to see more more of these incidents take place, although we do have faith, and we're, a lot of us is counting on this Meaningful Prisons Human Rights Coalition to get the job done, and that our voice is finally be heard. And we think once it happens, we're hoping that it will start the dismantling process of this prison industrial enslavement complex.
We saw the total corporate dependent media whiteout that occurred around the September 9th nationwide strikes. How do you see that kind of approach impacting the Millions for Prisoners Human Rights March in August?
Well, the actual whiteout that you mentioned in the media, that we expect them to try to do it again. Right now, this Meaningful for Prison Human Rights demonstration has spread throughout this country right now, and it's actually going spreading overseas, but yet we have not found much mention of it. And I think because it's a very scary thing to the country itself. And we know anything that is not set up to benefit the country, and right now, to rid your slave label, your free label, you will be crippling a company and corporation in this country right here, you know? You will be crippling a lot of other different areas of this country right here, social areas as well, you know, impacting jobs, you know. We'll be impacting how people there make money through communication devices as it relates to surveillance of ex-prisoners, you know. And to show you how much we know that this conflicts with the state and the government, we've already saw the government start to step up the repression of prisoners with any literature that they may have related to the 13th Amendment, and particularly in its reference to prison slave labor. We saw them start to come shake down prisoners, to even charge prisoners with disciplinary action when prisoners are ordering books that are pamphlets that are referenced to the 13th Amendment and prison slave labor. These particular books and pamphlets are being immediately turned around. I mean, this is happening in a variety of different states. So we fully expect them to try to write this out because, like I said, this goes against everything, the gigantic lie that they've sold since 1865 to everybody that we listen. So we understand what we're up against, but we are very hopeful that the numbers and the pressure that we're going to put on them from inside the prison into the streets will be so impactful that they will no longer be able to ignore us.
For those who perhaps won't be able to participate in the organizing process, but who may be able to attend, could you just address those individuals? Why should they make sure to be somehow involved in these demonstrations that are occurring on August 19th of this year?
Yes, it is very important that we want everyone to show. If you have any concern, any human decency, any concern for prisoners' human rights or any human rights in general, we're asking everybody to stop what you're doing for a moment and please find a local satellite demonstration that's taking place on August the 19th, or if you can get to Washington, D.C., that's going to be the first place we'll actually show up at. Please show up out there, because what it is when our voices are not heard, which is why they try to muffle prisoners' voices, when they are not heard, it is not a concern. But when we are heard and we motivate action, then we start to demand changes. Changes will actually start to take place. But no changes will take place if we do not demand it as the people. Power concedes nothing without demand. So we must demand change. So to say that I'm going to sit home and I'm going to let them do it, you may be taken away from the numbers. You know, we don't want anybody staying home on the couch. We need you out there in the streets. We need you out there with your fist in the air. We need you out there telling America to end slavery in this country today.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you will find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black left. I'm Nellie Bailey, along with my co-host, Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network.
You've been listening to the Black Agenda Report on the Progressive Radio Network. Information for liberation.